Welcome to the Jeffers Brief, only on Contra Radio Network.
And hello again, I'm John Jeffers here on the Jeffers Brief. All right, thank you. All right, before we get started, you know, the Jeffers Brief and the programs on Contra Radio Network are not just heard here in the United States, but all over the planet. And don't forget, we're also on KYAH, so if you're in the state of Utah, check us out on 5:40 a.m. We're there on Saturdays. But for the rest of the world, I want to acknowledge the citizens of those countries who have downloaded episodes of CRN. And it's Canada, Spain, the United Kingdom, Ireland, Russia, the Czech Republic, Bulgaria, Australia, New Zealand, Mexico, Austria, Japan, Iceland, and Guatemala. And believe it or not, Guatemala has downloaded the third most programs off our website, which is contraradionetwork.podbean.com. Thank you. Thank you, citizens of the world. I appreciate it. I hope it helps you in your preparations to be a good survivalist, to be a good patriot to your country by following our example here on CRN. Before we get started, what do I want to do before we get started? You know what? Who do we have? You know what? Let's listen to a Gator Gainer. Then we're going to get started. You know what? Hold on. We'll do that right now.
To all of the podcasters out there who are recording great content shows but are lacking the know-how or the time to edit your episodes into a concise finished product, I'm here to help. Hi, I'm Gator Gainer, and I've been producing radio shows for a long time, and I've recently stepped into the podcast producing world to assist people just like you. So if you're needing someone to take your recorded audio and make it into a produced package that's ready for distribution, get in touch and let's figure out a plan that works for you. You can hear an example of my work on the Prepping 2.0 podcast, as well as on my SoundCloud page. Just search for Gator Gainer. That's GatorGainor. Find me on Facebook and email me at gator.gainer@gmail.com. That's GATOR.GAYNOR@gmail.com.
Yes, I like Gator. I met him through Glenn and Shelby of Prepping 2.0, and I'll tell you, he knows his stuff, and he's really knowledgeable, to say the least. And for those of you out there thinking, you know what, I would like to do a podcast, get a hold of me, ContraRadio@live.com, ContraRadio@live.com. Let us speak and reason and see if we can't come up with a show that you would like to do. All right. Now, where do we get started? All right. It's been a big weekend. We know the Democrats are in absolute meltdown. We know that. But today, something interesting, and this is being reported by Sundance. Yeah, Sundance. It was reported yesterday. But you need to know, because the mainstream media isn't going to tell you anything about it. They don't want you to know. Just like they didn't want you to know that they knew there was no collusion. They knew that. Yet they still kept it up. Representative Schiff, Adam Schiff, the chairman of the House Intel Committee, this man who went around and continually told, he would go to any news outlet that would put him on, and he'd scream, "We have conclusive evidence. It's just not circumstantial. It's conclusive evidence that there's been collusion all along." Well, you know what? It dawned on me. You know what? This guy, if he had truly conclusive evidence of collusion, why didn't he turn it over to Mueller, the special prosecutor, special counsel? Why didn't he? If he truly had it, why didn't he do it? Because by doing so, he's withholding evidence. Just something to think about. It's like, you know, some of these people drive me bonkers. All right, let's get on to it. Nothing that happens with professional leftists is organic. Everything is always planned, organized, astroturfed, constructed, and schemed. Club officials control everything, plan everything, organize everything, and then enlist specific groups of designed foot soldiers. This is what they do. This is all they do. This is all they know how to do. It might seem subtle, but Team Trump has them off balance. How far off balance? Well, remember, they were playing for a sequence. The current objective, an increasingly difficult challenge, is to solidify the launch platform for the chosen one. The club is having a tough time controlling the newbies. The newest energetic leftists have demands. Demands that are against the interest of the club. The club calls in the Lightbringer in an effort to regain control. And the issue is serious. Can you imagine how desperate they are if they already need to go full Obama? It's quite telling. Now, Shimon Propich tweeted that Nancy Pelosi told her leadership team today that her caucus should focus on their agenda and their message and not the Mueller probe and Russia interference. She and her top lieutenants view the matter as a distraction and believe they should focus on pocketbook issues. Yeah, your pocketbook and how they're going to get into it. So Pelosi is trying to control the wildlings they created. The Moonbat activists are non-compliant. The wildlings want rage. They are like an emotional caucus who will not take direction. They refuse to calm down. Their intellectual handlers open a Pandora's box and tell them they only have 12 years to live before the planet is entirely destroyed. They believe it. Insert your panic emoji here. They will not have iPhones in 12 years. Desperate emoji here. They have already stopped breeding. It is taking more and more energy to try and control them. Pelosi and Obama see serious, serious trouble ahead. How are they going to launch Biden? Or the chosen one remains the question. Now, before we get crazy here, and I know if you've listened to the news, it's absolutely gone bonkers with the Mueller report and its conclusions. So, Bruce Fein of the American Conservative did a great little article, and it's clearing up some of the Mueller report's falsehoods. You got a lot of people who are guessing. Most of them are guessing. Very few of them actually know. But you need to know. That's why I'm here. Now, the airwaves, print, and social media are brimming with false or misleading statements about the Mueller report and Attorney General William Barr's letter to key members of Congress. As a concession to the shortness of life and to try and get it in here quickly, we would like to underscore the most egregious examples with some accompanying legal clarifications. Number one, the Mueller investigation wasted $25 million in a witch hunt because it found no criminal collusion or conspiracy between the Trump 2016 presidential campaign and Russia agents. False. The purpose of an investigation is not to prosecute a case, but to see that justice is done. Justice is vindicated when a prosecutor refrains from indicting individuals where the evidence seems insufficient to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt to impartial jurors. Remember, it's reasonable doubt, not, you know, shadow of a doubt, no doubt at all. It's reasonable doubt. Moreover, the Mueller investigation did establish criminal Russian endeavors to influence the outcome of the 2016 election in favor of Donald Trump. Now, that conclusion accords with the unanimous finding of Trump's intelligence agencies. It discredits Trump's insistence that Russian President Putin told him the truth in denying Russian interference. Number two, the Mueller investigation completely exonerates Trump. That is false. Trump could still be named as an unindicted co-conspirator by the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York in its ongoing federal election law investigation of Trump's payoffs to a porn star and Playboy bunny in exchange for silence about his adulteries to influence the outcome of the 2016 presidential election. President Richard Nixon was named as an unindicted co-conspirator in the Watergate cover-up prosecution by Special Prosecutor Leon Jarofsky. Additionally, the Mueller report did not exonerate Trump from an obstruction of justice prosecution once he departs the White House. It marshaled both incriminating and exculpatory evidence, but refrained from opining on whether the totality of the evidence proved guilt or innocence because he is bound by Justice Department policy against indicting or prosecuting a sitting president. To boost the political standing of Trump, Attorney General William Barr gratuitously decreed that obstruction was not proven. Barr's statement commands no legal standing and does not foresee a criminal prosecution of Trump once he leaves office. The Mueller report does not close the door on the possible impeachment of Trump by the House of Representatives for, quote, high crimes and misdemeanors, end quote. That concept reaches efforts to subvert the Constitution short of criminality. Article 1 of the three articles of impeachment voted against Nixon by the House Judiciary Committee that forces resignation charged him with making or causing to be made false or misleading public statements for the purpose of deceiving the American people about the Watergate cover-up. Additionally, the House could find evidence of obstruction sufficient for impeachment despite insufficiency for a criminal prosecution. The House so acted in impeaching Nixon and President Bill Clinton for obstruction of justice. Lastly, Trump could be summoned to testify before the House Judiciary Committee. Among other things, he might be asked about his public statements characterizing his motivation to fire FBI Director James Comey and directive to White House Counsel Donald McGahn to command Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein to fire Mueller, and his participation in a statement falsely describing a June 2016 meeting in Trump Tower between Donald Trump Jr. and Russians as about adoptions as opposed to receiving dirt on Hillary Clinton. Defiance of the House subpoena by Trump would be a separate impeachment offense according to the Nixon precedent. Now, Article 3 of impeachment articles voted by the House Judiciary Committee charged Nixon with disobedience to a subpoena issued in furtherance of its sole power of impeachment. Number 3. Now, Rule 6E of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedures prohibits Attorney General Barr from disclosing to Congress grand jury materials. False. That's a false. The rule authorizes grand jury disclosures in aid of the congressional impeachment power. Thus, Special Prosecutor Jaworski sought court authorization to disclose a 55-page roadmap of evidence assembled before a grand jury relevant to an impeachment investigation of Nixon. Chief Judge John Sirica and the D.C. Circuit approved, but there was one judge dissenting. This roadmap was used in determining whether to prepare articles of impeachment against Nixon. In sum, the Mueller report will only be the seventh inning stretch of a nine inning game. House Democrats can keep this going if they want, and they probably will. So there you have it. But this is far from over. You know that. I know that. So, Rudy Giuliani discussed the Mueller report findings. And he was speaking with Fox and Friends after the Mueller report found no evidence of a Trump-Russia conspiracy. President Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani issued a cryptic warning Monday that whoever convinced the FBI to pursue the Russian collusion investigation into the Trump campaign will soon be outed. Giuliani was asked whether someone tricked the FBI into opening the original investigation. Mr. Giuliani also called for President Trump's shameless critics to apologize for their false claims. Let us listen for yourself.
This is a Fox News alert. Mueller findings released. No collusion, no obstruction. Let's bring in Rudy Giuliani, President Donald Trump's attorney, former mayor of New York City. He joins us live from our nation's capital. Rudy, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You said yesterday that the findings were better than you expected. What do you mean?
Well, look, you know, I think that it's quite clear that this group was hardly a group of Trump fans. Is made up of almost all Democrats, some of them very, very rabid partisans, including one who was a lawyer for the Clinton Foundation. Pretty extraordinary. Don't know how they accomplished that. Another one who's a notorious prosecutor who's been in ethical trouble all throughout his career. They conducted an investigation as if this were a terrorism case or an obstruction of justice case. Rather, a organized crime case on their obstruction of justice and conspiracy theory. So they couldn't find it. If they can't find it, it's not there. Believe me, there was no obstruction of justice. There was no collusion. I just ask people to use your common sense. This investigation went on for 2 years. It cost actually about $40 million. 1.4 million documents. They got every document they wanted. They got every witness that they wanted. We stood in the way of nothing. Where's the obstruction? Weissman theory?
Right. Some of the other channels are saying, well, we can't count this because the president didn't sit down for an interview. What's your reaction?
Well, I think I made 5,000 prosecutorial decisions in my career. Some of the worst criminals of the 1980s. I rarely got to interview anyone, the people that I indicted and the people I declined. That's very extraordinary when you do that. I mean, only because he was the president was there any pressure to do it. If he were just a regular citizen out there, Jay and I, or Jane and Marty, you think we'd have him get even answer those questions? Of course not. He did that because he wanted to. And believe me, this is not something that usually happens. The real question now, though, is he's been absolved, vindicated, exonerated. You pick the word. Any lawyer never gets a letter like this. Usually you get a letter that says, we don't have enough evidence. In this case, we have complete vindication. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, the question now is, if there was no evidence of collusion, three investigations, no evidence of collusion, who made it up? This had to come from somewhere.
Right.
It didn't just didn't come out of thin air. I want to know who did it, who paid for it, who fueled it, because the person who did it and the group that did it knows it's untrue because they invented it.
Yeah, the president yesterday said it's time to look to the other side now. Last night we were all reading this report. I know your entire team was as well.
Well, this goes on for another 13 minutes. I'm not going to subject you to it, but it's out there. If you want to listen to it, please do. All right. Now, what have we got here? What do we want to... Oh, okay. Now, that's a review of the Barr Principal Conclusion Notification. Now, this is going to take some time, folks. Sundance put this together. This is 3 years of stuff. If you're just jumping in, if you miss something, if you're not sure what happened, this goes into at some of it into the granular level. That means it's detailed. We're going to take our time. Let's go through it. All right. Now, the origin of the DOJ FBI operation against Donald Trump goes back to 2015. The Mueller probe was a 2017 concluding chapter in the seditious conspiracy effort. So get your popcorn, get something to drink. If you're driving, stay driving. Please stay on the road. Don't go into the ditch because you hear something that drives you bonkers. Don't do that. All right. Excuse me. All right. Now we're going to try and cite as much background as possible. However, The review encompasses so much granular history that some parts might be too complex for a person who only recently jumped into the story. Now, this outline does not fit the narrative form of those who claim Mueller and Rosenstein are honorable men. They're not. Now, the first part that matters is a few paragraphs into the letter. And here we find the scale of the investigative group and a description of some of the investigative paths they traveled from the special counsel's report on Friday. This is Barr. On Friday, the special counsel submitted to me a confidential report explaining the prosecution or declination decisions he has reached, as required by federal law. This report is entitled Report on the Investigation into Russian Interference in the 2016 Presidential Election. Although my review is ongoing, I believe that it is in the public interest to describe the report and to summarize the principal conclusions reached by the special counsel and the results of his investigation. The report explains that the special counsel and his staff thoroughly investigated allegations that members of the presidential campaign of Donald J. Trump and others associated with it conspired with the Russian government in its efforts to interfere in the 2016 U.S. presidential election or sought to obstruct the related federal investigations. In the report, the special counsel noted that in completing his investigation, he employed 19 lawyers who were assisted by a team of approximately 40 FBI agents, intelligence analysts, forensic accountants, and other professional staff. The special counsel issued more than 2,800 subpoenas, executed nearly 500 search warrants, obtained more than 230 orders for communication records, issued almost 50 orders authorizing the use of pen registers, made 13 requests to foreign governments for evidence, and interviewed approximately 500 witnesses. This is how big it is. Now, there are several takeaways that are worthy of the notation. First, the team of 19 lawyers and 40 FBI agents is more than the original Crossfire Hurricane investigative team, they added lawyers, but includes the exact same group of FBI and DOJ staff level investigative officials that originated the Trump operation long before Mueller was selected to lead them. The transferring team assembly has been missed by media and also missed by those who have researched the investigators. It is an important point, yet completely overlooked. The same career staff unit that originated the unlawful activity to weaponize the DOJ and FBI is the same team that transferred into the Mueller probe. Their supervising officials changed. Comey, McCabe, Baker, Lynch, and Yates, and all were fired. However, the career investigative officials within the processes were identical. Now, the FBI agents transferred from Operation Crossfire Hurricane into the Mueller Special Counsel. Now, this is key. Heck, it's a critical point that is continually missed and glossed over. The Mueller Special Counsel in May of 2017 did not start from a clean state of investigators. Yes, new additional lawyers were added, but the investigators who conducted the Mueller probe were the same investigators who are carrying out the 2016 unlawful and illegal surveillance activity. Side note here, the reason that you want to have a whole new set of investigators is because you can get fresh eyes to look at something who don't have preconceived or knowledge thereof of the first ones. So you get those fresh eyes out there, you could very well possibly get a more clear picture one way or the other. That's why you do it. Now, initially, let's get back to it. Initially, Lisa Page and Peter Strzok also transferred to the Mueller team, but they had to be removed in July 2017 due to the discovery of their paper trail. If their paper trail had never been discovered, they would have remained with their comrades. And that takes us to an important sidebar that everyone forgets. Lisa Page and Peter Strzok were removed because Inspector General Horowitz accidentally stumbled upon their communication. Originally, Horowitz was looking at media leaks, and that led him to question FBI Director Andrew McCabe. McCabe denied the leaks. But when the IG questioned Lisa Page about media contacts, She said McCabe told her to give stories to the media. McCabe and Page were contradicting each other. The IG asked Page if she could prove her side of the story. Page said she had texts from McCabe and gave her phone to the INSD inspectors or investigators. The rest is history. Those IG investigators, while validating the instructions from McCabe, showing he lied, uncovered the Peter Strzok and Lisa Page bias and communication that set the groundwork for Spygate. The IG then had to inform Mueller of the compromised position. The second point that needs to be noted from these paragraphs is the scale of tools used by the special counsel. You follow me, right? Now we're going to talk about the tools they use. So on Friday, the special counsel submitted to me, this is Barr's report again, his summary, submitted to me a confidential report explaining the prosecution or declaration of decisions. Now we know about that, right? Remember, Mueller and Rosenstein reauthorized and resubmitted the third renewal of the Carter Page Title I, not Title III. FISA warrant in mid-July of 2017. Now, the Carter Page Title I warrant did not expire until mid-October 2017. So when we look at search warrants, subpoenas, and specifically 50 authorized pen registers, we should note most of them were generally not needed while the Page FISA warrant was active. When Mueller's team began, and remember, this is the same operational team, they're just using a new leader. They had the legal authority to conduct active electronic surveillance on any individual who was within two hops of Carter Page. So anyone who was in direct contact with Carter Page and anyone that person was in contact with and anyone that second person was in contact with, all of those officials were under surveillance. A typical two-hop Title I warrant ends up hitting a network between 900 to 2,500 people. That's a lot of people. The pen registers are trap and trace warrants. Essentially, it's another form of electronic surveillance, phone, email, etc., and extraction. They would not have been needed for anyone within the Carter Page orbit, the Trump campaign, until the Title I FISA warrant expired October 2017. The pen registers fall under Title III, ordinary, domestic, non-FISA-related DOJ suspect searches and inquiries, for example, phone taps. Now, between the Title I FISA warrant, the entire Trump orbit is captured, and the 50 pen registers, unknown orbit, and 500 search warrants, also a Title III. There was a massive dragnet of active surveillance and extraction of electronic forms from all targets. Active wiretaps or listening bugs would also fall under the FISA warrant and or the Title III pen registers. That gives us the scale of reach for those 40 active and assigned FBI agents. Understanding that President Trump was a defined initial target investigation, as also noted in the Barr letter, those wiretaps, electronic surveillance, phone intercepts, and listening bugs would have applied directly to President Trump in the White House. Now don't forget the by the book notation from President Obama. Now, do you think we'll ever hear about how Team Mueller took over active bugs within the White House? That's another story though. Again, I'm going to repeat. The same investigators who initiated the Trump operation in late 2015 through Spygate and into Crossfire Hurricane, which was in July of 2016, were the same investigators in May of 2017 when Mueller became their boss. That's 3 years of active electronic surveillance, intercepts, and extractions. Think about that. 3 years. Next, we move on to page two. Now here, A.G. Barr tells us the Mueller report has two elements: Russian interference, including Trump's potential collusion with Russians, and the second element is the obstruction investigation. To the summary, The special counsel's report is divided into two parts. The first describes the results of the special counsel's investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. The report outlines the Russian effort to influence the election and documents crimes committed by persons associated with the Russian government in connection with those efforts. The report further explains that a primary consideration for the special counsel's investigation was whether any Americans, including individuals associated with the Trump campaign, any Americans, you, me, any American, not just people that are associated with the Trump campaign itself. So they joined the Russian conspiracies to influence the election, which would be a federal crime. Now, the special counsel's investigation did not find the Trump campaign or anyone associated with it conspired or coordinated with Russia in its efforts to influence the U.S. election of 2016. As the report states, the investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities. The key point on the Russian collusion conspiracy aspect is not actually within Barr's letter, but is really the unwritten 800-pound gorilla in the corner of the letter. There was no actual Russian election interference to speak of. The entire premise was and is absurd. That doesn't mean they didn't try. That's the difference. And they've been trying since the early 1900s to interfere in U.S. elections. So, anyways, a Macedonian content farm producing memes on social media isn't exactly a vast Russian election conspiracy. So it is absurd that the predicate for the special counsel was to see if Trump was coordinating with irrelevant crap posting meme providers, etc. The lack of evidence for a premise that doesn't exist leads Robert Mueller to quote in his report, quote, "The investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities," end quote. No duh, really, you think? Now we have to wonder how long it took them to figure that out. Maybe it was something like this. Mueller, in May 2017, says, "Hey, Pete, did Trump's social media guys talk to those Macedonian dudes or repost their stuff?" Strzok, "Nope, not that we could ever find." Mueller, "Okay, well, that part of the investigation is over. After lunch, how about your guys move on to obstruction?" Strzok, "Gotcha." Unfortunately, that's only partially tongue-in-cheek. Come on. But anyways, let's look at the next paragraph. You ready? "The special counsel's investigation determined that there are two Russian efforts, main Russian efforts, to influence the elections. The first involved attempts by a Russian organization, the Internet Research Agency, also known as IRA, to conduct disinformation and social media operations in the United States designed to sow social discord, eventually with the aim of interfering with the election. As noted above, the special counsel did not find that any U.S. person, that's you or me, or anyone else you might know, or Trump campaign official or associate conspired or knowingly coordinated with the IRA in its efforts. Although the special counsel brought criminal charges against a number of Russian nationals and entities in connection with these activities." Now remember, Rosensnake made a grand splash about indicting the Internet Research Agency. However, he buried the indictment evidence in the DOJ National Security Division, never to be seen from or brought up ever again. The ridiculous nature of that February 2018 insufferable ruse was the breaking point for a conservative treehouse in giving Rosensnake any benefit of the doubt. Now, Sundance works for the CTH. It was after that that they found, they said, this guy can't be trusted to even do that right. Well, you know, they wouldn't even trust Rosensnake to go out and get their mail. It was and is transparently obvious that Team Mueller and Rosensnake, the Deputy Attorney General, needed to throw up something, anything, that would validate the fraudulent Marussia premise behind the corrupt DOJ-FBI political operation that was started back in 2015. The IRA indictments were theatrics, a ruse, a cover. Hell, even the damned Washington Post noted it. Now, WAPO says here, a 37-page indictment issued by Special Counsel Robert Mueller III's team on Friday brings fresh American attention to one of the strangest elements of an alleged Russian interference in the 2016 election. The Internet Research Agency, which is IRA, a state-sponsored troll factory in St. Petersburg. But much of the information Mueller published on Friday about the agency's efforts to influence the election had already been published last October in an article by a Russian business magazine, the RBC. So in a 4,500-word report titled How the Troll Factory Worked the U.S. Elections, journalists Polina Rosieva and Andrei Zakharov offered the fullest picture yet of how the American Department of the IRA, the IRA, used Facebook, Twitter, and other tactics to inflame tensions ahead of the 2016 vote. The article also looked at the staffing structure of the organization and revealed details about its budgets and salaries. Someone get a banana for the 800-pound gorilla. I hear CNN has extras, so never mind. So the next part of Barr's letter, as determined from the investigative material provided by Team Mueller, is even more disingenuous as it pertains to Russia. So here we go again. The second element, this is from Barr's letter, involved the Russian government's efforts to conduct computer hacking operations designed to gather and disseminate information to influence the election. The special counsel found that the Russian government actors successfully hacked into computers and obtained emails from persons affiliated with the Clinton campaign and the Democratic Party organizations, and publicly disseminated those materials through various intermediaries, including WikiLeaks. Based on these activities, the special counsel brought criminal charges against a number of Russian military officers for conspiring to hack into the computers of the United States for the purpose of influencing the election. But as noted above, the special counsel did not find that the Trump campaign or anyone associated with it conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in these efforts, despite multiple offers from Russian-affiliated individuals to assist the Trump campaign. So how could the special counsel find that the Russian actors hacked into computers without being able to do a forensic audit of the servers for the DNC? What? Huh? No, really, wait. Notice how this is oddly worded. You ready? Hacked into computers and obtained emails from persons affiliated with the Clinton campaign and Democratic Party organizations. That's important. That paragraph could be describing anyone. Those who are skilled in reviewing professionally obtuse legalese verbiage from the government would immediately pick up something. They are not saying the DNC was hacked. And we know Podesta was not hacked. He was a victim of a phishing password change. Oh, the gorilla just farted. The next segment is just as priceless when overlaid against what technically is not stated in the first. The special counsel did not find that the Trump campaign or anyone associated with it conspired or coordinated with the Russian government these efforts, despite multiple offers from Russian-affiliated individuals to assist the Trump campaign. Everyone here is projecting Hillary Clinton emails into this statement, but the Clinton emails were never hacked, stolen, or released. Remember, there were 30,000 missing Clinton emails that supposedly never surfaced until the Wiener laptop was discovered. But the second segment says these efforts, and it's not exactly clear what these efforts mean because nothing in this paragraph makes any sense. What are these efforts? Let's read it again and see if you can make sense of it. The key takeaway from this entire Russian interference part is that there wasn't actually any Russian interference. So the predicate for Trump to be investigated for colluding or conspiring to do something that technically wasn't being done is just silly. And that's the frustrating part of this entire 3 years. The Russian interference narrative was constructed ex post facto to cover for a political surveillance operation that was targeting candidate Donald Trump during the presidential election. The Carter Page FISA warrant, which is the insurance policy, was needed as cover for the investigative data trail and time spent by the FBI officials enlisted in the surveillance operation. Now, before I go on, I want to go back. You know, you're going to hear people scream, but they got hacked, they got hacked. They were not hacked. They were not hacked. They were the victim of a phishing password change. They would send you an email. They sent these people's email, and the email would say, you know, you've been hacked or whatnot. Push click here to reset your password. Da 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 da. Well, the bozos did it. They didn't check into if it was a phishing scam. They said, oh, we've been hacked, and then they push the button, and now they go in there and they say, here, give us, you know, they say, type in your email. Okay. And they typed in their email. Type in your password, your old password. Okay. And they typed in the password. Type in your new password. Okay. And they did it. They were not hacked. They weren't smart enough to realize it was a phishing password change. There's a difference. Okay, let's get back to it. All right. The investigation into something that didn't exist was predicated as a cover for something the DOJ and FBI were trying to hide. Considering that Mueller came on board in May of 2017, there's no doubt he realized that within weeks, if he didn't know that from the outset. So after we accept that the Russian narrative was entirely false, when we move to the obstruction narrative, we find out why they spent so much time on it. Without any actual Russian interference to collude or conspire with, the possible obstruction case was the only case that could have ever existed. And it is within the obstruction nonsense where anger over this fiasco really starts to settle in, and there's absolutely no room to consider Robert Mueller and or Rod Rosenstein anything except complicit with the sedition team. What we find in the Barr letter about the obstruction investigation is going to drive you bonkers. You're going to be screaming at your steering wheel, and you're going to be screaming at your cell phone as you're listening to this, or your computer as you're listening to me. Here, Team Mueller intentionally politicized their non-finding in an attempt to open the door for Nancy Pelosi and Jerry Nadler to exploit an impeachment angle. Obstruction of Justice is Barr's letter. The summary, ready? The report's second part addresses a number of actions by the president, most of which have been the subject of public reporting that the special counsel investigated as potentially raising obstruction of justice concerns. After making a thorough, what is this? No. Request is denied. Request denied all the way around. I don't know. Here we go. Yes, we'll do that. All right. Sorry. Had to take care of that. I'm not going to have it bothering me anymore. I will start again. The part addresses a number of actions by the president, most of which have been subject of public reporting, that the special counsel investigates potentially raising obstruction of justice concerns. So after making a thorough factual investigation into these matters, the special counsel considered whether to evaluate the conduct under department standards governing prosecution and declination decisions, but ultimately determined not to make a traditional prosecutorial judgment. The special counsel, therefore, did not draw a conclusion, one way or the other, as to whether the examined conduct constituted obstruction. Instead, for each of the relevant actions investigated, the report sets out evidence on both sides of the question and leaves unresolved what the special counsel views as quote-unquote difficult issues of law and fact concerning whether the president's actions and intent could be viewed as obstruction. The special counsel states that while this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him. Now, what the hell does that mean? All right. The special counsel's decision to describe the facts of his obstruction investigation without reaching any legal conclusion leaves it to the attorney general to determine whether the conduct described in the report constitutes a crime. Over the course of the investigation, the special counsel's office engaged in discussions with certain department officials regarding many of the legal and factual matters at issue in the special counsel's obstruction investigation. After reviewing the special counsel's final report on these issues, consulting with department officials, including the Office of Legal Counsel, and applying the principles of federal prosecution that guide our charging decisions, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosensnake and I have concluded that the evidence developed during the special counsel's investigation is not sufficient to establish that the president committed an obstruction of justice offense. Our determination was made without regard to and is not based on the constitutional considerations that surround the indictment and criminal persecution of a sitting president. In making this determination, we note that the special counsel recognized that the evidence does not establish that the president was involved in an underlying crime related to Russian election interference, and that, while not determinative, the absence of such evidence bears upon the president's intent with respect to obstruction. Generally speaking, to obtain and sustain an obstruction conviction, the government would need to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a person acting with corrupt intent engaged in obstructive conduct with a sufficient nexus to a pending or contemplated proceeding. In cataloging the president's actions, many of which took place in public view, the report identifies no actions that, in our judgment, constitute obstructive conduct, had a nexus to a pending or contemplated proceeding, and were done with corrupt intent, each of which, under the department's principles of federal prosecution guiding charging decisions, would need to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt to establish an obstruction of justice offense. Now, you're saying, John, what did you just say? I'm going to tell you. Team Mueller intentionally tells AG Barr they cannot make a determination of obstruction and thereby force Barr to make the decision and make it look political. The obstruction angle was always what Team Mueller were working to deliver in collaboration with their Democratic political allies. Now, in the opinion, it's almost certain A.G. Barr saw this coming, which is why he forced Rosensnake Weaselstein to stick around and share in the decision and deflect the politics. Barr is no fool, my friends. And this is my opinion, me, John Jeffers, telling you what my opinion is. Oh, by the way, it doesn't mean anything, just what I think. And that is this. If the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Nadler, calls Barr and tries in front of the committee to testify, Barr will tear Nadler up. Anyway, so in summary, it is almost certain that Team Mueller knew from the outset there was no Russian collusion conspiracy because, one, it's the same team from 2016 through 2019, and two, they knew from the outset there was no there. So a reasonable question would be, how long did Mueller investigate conspiracy with Russia before jumping to obstruction of justice? I think the answer is that Mueller abandoned the Russia angle around August 2017 when he asked Rosensnake for an updated scope memo. Everything from August 2017 through to March 2019 was Mueller and his team trying to prove an obstruction case of a predicate Russian investigation that was non-existent and based on a false premise. We have every right to be angry about this. Now you got an idea. I know some of you don't care. I do care. As a patriot, I care. All right. What are we thinking here? All right, here we go. For some of you out there, how small state Democrats are selling out their states to California. This is coming to a small state near you. Now, I want you to follow this carefully. When I tell you about it, you're going to go, what? And then you're going to stop it. You're going to rewind it. I want to hear this again. And you're going to have to do it two or three times, and you start to see what the hell the Democrats are doing. All right, here we go. This is from Daniel Greenfield. Now, he's a Shulman Journalism Fellow at the Freedom Center. He's an investigative journalist and writer who focusing on the radical left and Islamic terrorism. Colorado has a population of about 5.7 million, or 1.75% of the country. Despite that, Governor Jared Polis, a Democrat, signed on to the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact after Colorado's General Assembly passed the National Popular Vote Bill by 34-29. The bill to disenfranchise Colorado voters was sponsored by Senator Mike Foote, a Democrat, Representative Elmi Sirota, a progressive Democrat, and Jenny James Arndt, a Democrat. The bill passed in a party-line vote, with Democrats lining up to make Colorado politically irrelevant. Now, the popular vote bill conspires to bypass the Electoral College and toss out the votes of Coloradans by awarding the state's Electoral College voters to the winners of the popular vote, also known as whichever candidate New York and California billionaires decided should run the country. Now, California has a population of almost 40 million. New York has a population of almost 20 million. Both states would vote in a chicken, a serial killer, or Adolf Hitler if he had a D after his name. Hell, it could have been Idi Amin, too. Colorado does even have 6 million people to put up against that 60 million. If the compact were to take hold, why then should any presidential candidate ever bother campaigning in Colorado again? In the last election, Donald J. Trump, Hillary Clinton held rallies in Colorado. But if Colorado's electoral votes go to whomever New York and California elites pick, there would be no point. New York alone has 3 million more people than Colorado. They're all boxed in within 300 square miles. Meanwhile, Colorado voters are scattered across over 100,000 square miles. Even Denver only has a population density of about 1,700 per square mile. New York has 27,000 people per square mile. Why would any presidential nominee bother hunting and pecking for Colorado voters when Los Angeles County has 10 million people with a density of 7,500 people per square mile that he can just scoop up? This really isn't a red versus blue idea. Senator Mike Foote lied. This is about making sure that the President of the United States is elected by the entire nation. The only reason Colorado's elected officials chose to disenfranchise their state is that they are thinking like Democrats, not like Coloradans. They're satisfied with only having input during the Democratic primary process, and they don't care if both candidates ignore their state during the general election. The 11 states that have signed on to the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact are a curious combination of winners and losers. California and New York, the states with the most to gain from being able to determine presidential elections, are on board. But on the other side of the dial are Hawaii, Rhode Island, and Vermont. The three states together weigh in at a little over 3 million. The compact puts Colorado in a grim place, but it's still almost twice as populous as all three tiny states combined. Their only political assets were their Electoral College votes, and they chose to give those assets away to New York and California in the hopes of rigging a future presidential election. Now, New Mexico, which is feverishly trying to join, has a little over 2 million people. The Electoral College was meant to protect the political power of even the smallest states, but Democrats in some of those states are eager to abandon local power for national control. The National Popular Vote Interstate Compact nationalizes local votes in a trick of political socialism. Why are small state Democrats so willing to abandon their rights and power of their states? Now, these are the questions. Take Polis. He's a California tech industry guy worth around $400 million. After inheriting a greeting card company from his parents, he bought his seat by outspending everyone else. Now, Polis is typical of the new blue elite transforming the country. His fortune may be impressive by the standards of Colorado politics, but spending a few million wouldn't have bought him anything in California or New York. Just ask Tom Steyer, who blew through tens of million dollars for nothing, or Bloomberg, who spent over $100 million to buy just one mayoral election in New York City. Colorado elections are much more affordable. So over in Rhode Island, the popular vote bill was signed by Governor Chaffee. What a goof he was. His own conflicts were bad enough, and his successor, Gina Raimondo, who worked in a venture capital firm in Manhattan, outspent her opponents by millions in a campaign funded by out-of-state donors, the finance industry, and major executives. Her transition team was packed with banking executives. Is that the bile of a politician who cares about state sovereignty? Raimondo managed to raise $2.2 million in campaign money in a non-election year in a state with a million people. $1.35 million came from out of state. Only $872,000 came from Rhode Island. Much of Raimondo's cash came from California donors, including Hollywood and the tech industry. When California and New York money elects politicians in Colorado and Rhode Island, is it any wonder that it also controls their votes? Now, the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact isn't about fairness. It ratifies the power shifts from the traditional political system that is built to protect the sovereignty of small states against the financial and cultural power of New York, Pennsylvania, and Virginia to new culture and economic powerhouses. The problem isn't mere geography, people. This isn't civil war pitting state against state. New Yorkers and Californians aren't the problem. New York and California are dominated by conglomerations of financial and cultural elites from outside the respective states that have disenfranchised state voters, as they thoroughly have in Colorado. Whew. How much time have I got? Ooh. Got 2 minutes. Look, I'm going to tell you right now. The National Popular Voter State Compact is really bad for the country. I mean, we could keep on going on with it, and you're going to be going, oh, man. But type it in. National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. What could possibly happen there? What could it possibly be? Well, there you go. Okay. Have we got time for our favorite, for your favorite segment? Barely. But I think we probably could. Let me see if I can find it real quick. And we'll do it. We will do it. Yes, we're going to do it. I know it's your favorite time. So here we go. All right, here we go. Let's find out what the social justice warriors are up to. Well, it's like Yale rescinds the acceptance of a student admitted via college admissions scandal. A gay teacher was fired for having sex with teen boys, wins a discrimination case. And University of Nebraska Lincoln professor links students' OK hand symbol to the Christchurch killer. Of course they do. We have New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy. He looks forward to signing the assisted suicide bill for his state. University of Colorado Denver politics course removes white authors from the curriculum. Say it ain't so. University of Georgia students in Pick My Cotton video is expelled from the fraternity, as they should be. That's stupid. Three have been arrested after arson attack on Tulane Turning Point USA President's dorm room. Is, yes, that bad. Look, okay, we're just about out of time. I'm John Jeffers here for the Jeffers Brief and Contra Radio Network, and on 540 AM, the KYAH. Hope to listen to you then. Listened up. Hey, $2. $2! That's all I'm asking for, a donation. $2. Have a good one. We'll see you next.